Hello, gorgeous ones.
Hello.
Welcome back to Straight Up, the pop culture podcast hosted by us journalists Kathleen and Ellie.
I'm Ellie.
How are you doing today, babe? I'm Kathleen.
Just so you get the voices right.
Oh my God, how surprising was it when one of the honeys and then several lights said that they'd got our voices the other way around?
I know.
If it was you and you're listening, sorry that we have accidentally misled you all. And thank God we're starting to drop some video so you can actually see
yes.
who too.
I wonder what it is about my face that gives husky
my energy
radio voice.
Oh God, I am feeling all over the place today. I have to be honest. I am a bit of an anxious wreck.
Oh babe, I know. We had to do a bit of a hug before recording.
We
both of us
did.
Feel completely on the edge.
And it's quite unusual for us to have any physical contact.
Yeah, it is.
So a hug was really serious.
Yeah, it was serious.
I feel like such a bloody cliche. I was in Greece doing wedding planning last week. Literally the biggest first world problem ever. I'm very aware that I sound like the biggest brat on earth and I'm mortified to even be saying these words, but I'm getting the wedding anxiety.
Oh, hon, I know.
Don't know why, because I know it's ridiculous, but I just can't help but be freaking out about the sheer amount of things that you have to do and just worrying about people having a good time, and there's so many different elements and you're spending so much money. I don't know, there's just, it's a recipe for anxiety, it really is.
I have to say, yeah, as someone, since you get overwhelmed easily and you're a very anxious person and you worry about how people are, then yeah, I can imagine yes. organising a wedding is possibly like the most stressful like, thing for you yeah. ever. But you're doing really well.
Kind.
And
thank you.
And you're going to have an amazing time. Also, I think just the fact that it's abroad, it will be hot. So like the heat just chills you out.
So I did feel much better about everything actually going to Lefkada, because I was like, oh yeah, this is just such a nice place that everyone's going to enjoy it by default of just the location.
We're going to be so
you
excited.
Know, the bloody flowers or what people are specifically like drinking or eating ultimately don't really matter.
No, of course not.
If any brides have any tips for me, please do share. I need to get in the gym. I've been terrible with exercise. Absolutely typical in the run up to my wedding. I've been to the gym. I'm not joking, like 4 times this entire year.
Yes. Well, we were just saying, isn't it? It's difficult to prioritize your physical well-being when you're freelancing and you feel
it
like
really
everything, every second is on your like paid clock.
Exactly. And then having all this other like unusual life admin to do on top of it has just meant that it's gone on the back burner so much, which is really silly because it's not about how I look. It's about how I feel.
Yeah.
And my God, do I need to go and do some exercise?
I promise we're going to love it. I've never not enjoyed a wedding.
No, you're right.
Have you ever not enjoyed a wedding?
No, they're always lovely.
Exactly. I'm so excited. I cry at strangers' weddings. So the way I'm going to cry at your wedding is like,
oh my God, I know. I need to really hold it together. I'm worried about just sobbing the entire time.
Do you think you will?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, but it's quite cute when they cry. Like, they always cry. I always find at weddings, the guy always cries more.
Yeah, they do.
And Marlon is going to be crying.
Oh, he will. He's worried about getting through it all, I think. But yeah, anyway,
but tips, yeah, if anyone has been to a wedding and come out the other side, well, hopefully that's everyone
that's
who's got married.
Pretty much everyone, I would hope.
Send us reassuring tips to Straight Up Pod on Instagram.
That would be lovely, thank you, my
soothing
sweet
messages.
Yeah. Most kind.
Also, can the weather fucking get a grip, because it's sending me.
Yeah, and can that bloody drill in the background stop it as
that's
well?
That's how we feel, and that's the anxiety drilling through our brains right now.
I'd like to start today with a little bit of fun celebrity goss.
Go on.
Because when do we not love a little bit of celebrity goss?
That's kind of why we're here.
So, Kate Moss.
Yes.
I think perhaps may or may not have a new paramour.
Go on.
As reported in that very reliable publication, The Daily Mail.
Yes.
Again, I only ever look at the sidebar of shame for work purposes. That is my excuse. Mm-hmm. Kate was spotted holding hands with Bob Marley's grandson, Skip Marley.
How old is he? 27.
She's of course 50, so we love that for her. Another age gap relationship.
50. Wow. I do love that, because it's really making me reevaluate my judgment, because if I was 50 and one of my male friends was dating a 27-year-old woman, I would be so judgmental of that. But for some reason I'm not, because the power dynamics.
I mean, she's Kate Moss, so
yeah.
Do you know, I think I read this in Pop Bitch the other day, but we've talked on air before about celebrity kind of image management and how you can specifically use SEO to try and change your digital footprint.
Oh yeah, with the Jets, Taylor Swift and the Jets.
Yeah, exactly. So if you didn't hear us talk about this, guys, we were saying that Taylor Swift going to the Jets game was perhaps like a PR move to knock all the information about her being a massive private jet user kind of off the top spot on Google. But anyway, apparently now, when you Google Kate Moss Coke,
Yes.
It is, of course, her Diet Coke collaboration that comes up. And it's been a kind of ingenious move because finally, once and for all those sordid cocaine stories have been pushed pages and pages back.
I read that last week. I thought that was so clever, if that is indeed the case.
It was part of the thinking of why she actually took the collab on in the first place. I mean, it was highly lucrative, wasn't it? It was like millions and millions.
I saw that her modelling agency is doing so well.
Is it?
Mm.
Oh, I love a bit of Kate.
Yeah. I wonder if she is a good businesswoman or she's just employed all the right people.
Doesn't she have some kind of skincare brand now as well that's slightly sort of aromatherapy based?
Don't they all
have a skincare brand?
Yes.
True.
They all have a skincare brand and a book club. Megan Grubb is starting a book club. Did you see? I saw that.
I was like, wow, really? Well and truly, everyone has a book club. Guys, I love a bit of Megan, but I feel like all she ever reads is Colleen Hoover. Not to be a hater.
Guys, do you find it funny when we hate on people, or do you think
that
we should stop?
Evil bitches. Actually, you know I love Megan Grubb. You know I'm a big fan. But Grubb. I've never read any Colleen Hoover. I just know that she's considered quite a basic author. Is she not? I don't know. Guys, have you read any Colleen Hoover? Can you let us know your thoughts? Should we be reading Colleen Hoover?
Yeah, I've got too much other stuff to read. Most importantly, the memoir from a sociopath. Oh, also, should we start a book club? Should we start a book
jump
club?
Jump on the wagon with everyone else. We have been talking about starting a Substack for about 2 years.
Yes, we have.
We can shoehorn our book club in there.
Well, we might do like an August book club when we're away.
Yes.
Let us know your thoughts on that.
I think we did quite a lot of book stuff last summer, didn't we?
Yeah, just so that we can have a bit of a break and go on holiday.
If we're allowed.
Would you let us?
Do you know, talking of books that we love, this is not a pity memoir up there keeps catching my eye. So there's a memoir on my bookshelf that Ellie lent me over a year ago now that we'd never spoke about on air. And I'm desperate to. No, we've never talked about it on air. Yes. And I've been watching Dark Matter recently, which is a new series on Apple TV. And it kind of reminded me of it because the main character, played by Joel Edgerton, basically finds himself kind of in his life, not recognising his partner or anyone. So if you remember, it's by the TV writer Abby Morgan, and it details her experience of her husband having this kind of terrible reaction, in fact, to an experimental drug that he was on. I believe he had MS and he was in some trials and he had this awful reaction to this drug where it was a kind of brain injury whereby he felt that his wife was an imposter.
Yes.
And it's a really specific syndrome that's, of course, really unusual. But he was absolutely convinced that Abby wasn't really Abby and that everyone else in his life was. But she'd almost taken root in their home as some kind of like FBI informant.
Yes. It wasn't that he had lost the memories of Abby because he was convinced there was a real Abby Morgan, but just that she was
that
not.
It just wasn't her. Yeah.
And it's brilliantly written because Abby Morgan, who wrote The Split, is a scriptwriter. So it's a memoir, but written as if it's almost cinema.
I didn't know she wrote The Split.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's written in this incredibly vivid, like, screenplay-esque way.
Yes.
Which means, of course, it's been picked up for the screen. So in 2022, I saw that it had been picked up for TV. So it's surely soon it will start production, but I haven't seen rumours of it.
I'm really excited for that.
And yeah, let's not spoil what happens. I know it's like real life, so it can't really be a spoiler, but I won't spoil the end. But like, it's not as grim as it sounds. I think it's really a love story.
It is. Yes, I think that's a lovely way to put it.
Just
it's really great.
Yeah.
Highly recommend, guys. We will pop it in the show notes.
Well, talking of books, I have another really great recommendation.
Go on.
Arrangements in Blue.
Ooh, is this the one you mentioned that you read in Lisbon?
Yes.
I've been so excited to hear about this.
So it's by British poet Amy Key, who I'd never heard of before, but I remember Dolly Alderton raving about this book. It's a memoir. Dolly described it as the book I've been waiting for my entire life.
Aww.
And it's a memoir that Amy started writing in 2020, age 43. And it's kind of a memoir about living as a single woman. She's been single since, I think, her late 20s. Not necessarily by choice, but she kind of examines what it means to be a single woman in terms of self-love and societal expectations and feeling like you're less because you don't have a partner. And the title, Arrangements in Blue, is a riff on Joni Mitchell's breakup album, Blue. So basically, Amy Key was obsessed with that album when she was growing up, and it really influenced and shaped her expectation of romantic love because the album is so raw and so painful. Amy had in her head from the beginning, that like romantic love had to be painful. She said she was gripped by the idea of love as an exquisite pain rather than joy, which this is me kind of extrapolating, but I imagine therefore that maybe her struggle to find romantic partners in life has been because she kind of had a kind of warped idea of what love should be. Therefore, if it's just like happy and normal, it's not real. She wanted like intense passion all the time. Yes.
When I think Joni Mitchell, I just think of that heartbreaking scene in Love Actually with Emma Thompson's character.
Yes.
When she opens Joni Mitchell's best hits, greatest hits, instead of the jewellery from Alan Rickman's character.
Oh, of course.
So sad.
It's a beautiful album. So there are a few things that I want to bring up from this memoir that I think will be very comforting for those single honeys listening, but also I think is important for those also in relationships to think about the self as separate to your partner. And in fact, very fitting for you, Cathers, as you're about to embark on married life. So the memoir asks questions about whether intimacy is possible in a life lived in the absence of romantic love, what the soul means when you have no soulmate, and what takes shape in romantic love's absence. And she wonders throughout if we all lose by centering romantic love so much in our lives. And actually her kind of biggest realization throughout the memoir that her therapist kind of tells her is she is scared, not because she doesn't have a partner, but because she kind of has realized that she's not deficient without one. And realizing that she doesn't need one is almost like scarier to accept than like the sense of I'm not good enough to have one.
Oh, wow.
Because it's like a much bigger concept in a way.
God, it sounds very vulnerable.
And she, really vulnerable. And she kind of debunks the idea that to achieve self-love, you have to be loved by someone else first. Because I think that's such a cliche that we talk about when we talk about love. It's like, he helped me love myself.
See, I actually disagree. I think it's really the other way around. The classic kind of phrase is you can't be loved by someone else until you love yourself.
That's true. I would say, yeah, I think in recent years the whole like self-love
has been like flipped on its head.
It's been flipped on its head. Nevertheless, I guess maybe I still, when I read books or watch films and stuff, it's often still the former.
I do know what you mean. A romantic relationship often leads to sort of self-realization.
Yes.
In these kind of narratives.
Exactly. But you're right that like our focus on self-love in recent, like the last 10 years, very much prioritises doing it on your own. She's, by the way, we're talking about heteronormative relationships in this case because Amy Key is heterosexual.
But how old is she?
She is now 43. And she talks a lot about the pain she felt realising on her 37th birthday after years of being like, I don't want children and I'm totally fine with that, realising that she desperately did want children. And her sister was like, you can't really do it. You're a single mother. You'd be a single mother living in London. You can't afford it. And then she went on these sites to see what sperm donors were available. And she said that she was so put off by the men insistent on natural insemination. Like,
what?
Like men who like wanted to be her sperm donor, but insisting on natural insemination, i.e. they're clearly just on wanna there have to sex. Have sex.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that was an option on those kind of websites. Yeah. I thought sperm donation was from a sort of sperm bank where they like provided a sample, not
no.
a flipping weird hookup opportunity.
Exactly.
No, so that sounds really...
She said she had so many of those offers. Yeah, that she kind of was off put by it. And then she got to her 43rd birthday and was like, wow, I now have to realise that like realistically I'm not, that like that door has closed for me now. And she talks about how difficult it is to seem like a functioning adult around other people who have children, which I think people maybe who are living a child-free lives have probably had to navigate themselves. She said, I find myself scanning my life for parallels that allow me to join in, to somehow present myself as having parental type attributes and concerns. This feels important as a way of saying, I too am an adult. My life is as serious as yours. But she feels really inauthentic by doing that. She says she wants to talk about her two cats, which for her are her way, are the way she feels most similar to these parents, because she like has to keep them alive and care for them. But she feels that like if she talks about her two cats when other people talk about their children, they'll judge her for being like a crazy cat lady. She was sad, but like I totally see
that. I could definitely see that being a difficult dynamic.
And I think another really important thing that she talks about, which I really loved, was the idea of, she says that when you have a partner, a romantic partner, your life is often divided into stages of milestones, for instance. So you might get engaged and then you get married and then maybe you'll have a child and then maybe you'll move from a flat into a house and then maybe you'll move out of a city. And, you know, there are all these ways to stay, to divide your life into stages that you're moving up in your life. Whereas if you're a single person, you don't have any of those milestones. And so your life can feel like the line can feel very flat. And so she felt like she needed to really focus on things she could do for herself to like delineate these different stages in her life for herself. So for instance, she buys herself an opal ring. That means a lot to her.
I think that's so important. And I think we are definitely all becoming a little bit more cognizant to the fact that single people need to have their lives celebrated too, whether that's totally promotions or whether that's incredible like achievements in terms of personal goals, whether that's running, you know, that could be running a marathon, that could be doing a course. But this has been a talking point, I think, culturally for decades. It actually really reminds me of an episode of Sex and the City, like the OG Sex and the City. So it was probably came out in the 90s, where Carrie just gets sick to death of going and celebrating her friends' lives with all these ridiculous milestones. Well, not ridiculous at all. Sorry, that's not the way to put it. But she feels like she's schlepping around like the suburbs of New York, going to endless baby showers, having to buy all these presents on gift registries.
Yeah.
And so she decides at the end to set herself up a gift registry. And she's like, I'm marrying me.
Yes.
And puts a load of like Manolo Blahniks on her registry.
Yeah.
And I think quite right too. Why shouldn't single people be equally celebrated?
Totally. And it's something I've definitely spoken about with my single friends of like, why don't you make as much of a fuss of a promotion as your engagement or whatever? But Amy Key says she feels she does put a lot of focus on making others, well, not making, but suggesting others celebrate her achievements. But she has to really do it herself. She can't just wait for others to
notice. It's got to be self-led. I actually read a really lovely one of, you know, Dolly Alderton's Agony Aunt pieces in the Times. There was one who was complaining that her partner of 10 years, while they wanted to grow old together and were really in love, didn't want to get married. And she did. And she couldn't help but feel like a kind of bitter jealousy at her friends' weddings, seeing them have the big kind of white day. And also mentioned that she'd lost her father young. And so seeing friends not only have the big day, but also having their fathers walk them down the aisle, you know, it just kind of stirred up complicated feelings for her. And Dolly's response was so lovely because she basically suggested alternate ways of looking at it. So firstly, she did, of course, suggest that she has conversations with her partner about what a less traditional wedding could look like and how they could do it on their own terms. But what I thought was really sweet was when she talked about actually for the op-eds find ways themselves to carve out celebrations. So Dolly suggests having a big birthday party that almost feels like a wedding. So she's like, you know, get the designer dress, invite all your friends, you know, pay for an open bar, make it really special, get a photographer, get your makeup done. You don't have to only do those things at a wedding. All of those signifiers that we often consider a part of that experience can be done in really amazing ways. I think she said that she did something like that for her 30th.
Yes, totally. And that's what Amy Key talks about, is like that desire to want to do, like do the little wedding invites and like do all those special things that, as you say, you only associate with weddings. I love that. I love that idea. And I think we all need to be more aware of people's milestones that aren't
definitely
just getting engaged and getting married and having a child. I'm trying to be more aware of like people's careers or I don't know, whatever it might be.
I totally agree. I think it's very flattening and it's really important that we keep these conversations going.
And finally, this is a smaller point, but I really felt this, and some of my single friends who I read this out to when I was with them also really felt it as well, which is the kind of resentment when you're single of doing like domestic things on your own. So she says like, sometimes when I try and get the duvet in its cover, I feel a pathetic sense of unfairness that it is only me who has responsibility for it. Or occasionally when I prepare a meal, I resent clearing away the dishes. Because I guess domesticity, you imagine the perfect domestic sphere is like, I'll do one thing and then you do the other, or you'll do things together. And
it's when like you're a share of labor.
Yeah. Whereas when you're single, you have to just do everything on your own. It takes so much more time.
But on the plus side, you do everything on your own terms. So you might not even make the ridiculously labor intensive meal that requires 1,000,000,000 dishes.
Exactly. But then also I remember talking to one of my single friends who was like, it's really important for me to make elaborate meals for myself.
Very good point. Actually, there's a TikToker that I really like that her whole series is Dinners for One.
Aww.
And making that real effort to cook special meals as you would for two or for four, as in conventional recipes, for yourself.
I recently made myself a roast, an entire roast, like with the full whole chicken for myself. And I took 3 hours and everyone was like, you're not going to be able to eat it. Well, I did, just over 3 days. And it was great. Yeah,
yummy. Did you do the trimmings?
I did potatoes and like different veg.
Love that for you.
But I didn't know. So I elevated the chicken with an onion because apparently having it like not in the sauce is good for it not going soggy.
Oh, I see what you mean. Underneath, you almost use it as a little bolster. I do that sometimes with chopped up onion and carrot.
Yes.
And sit it on the top.
Yes.
Within the roasting tray, of course.
Of course.
Riveting stuff for you guys there. Sorry.
Right, Cathers, we have got to talk about Fiona Harvey's interview with Piers Morgan.
The big topic of today, we cannot not get into this. I watched it a couple of days ago. I felt quite conflicted about watching it. So guys, if you don't know, I'm sure you all do, the alleged real life Martha Scott, so the stalker character in Baby Reindeer, who was identified by internet sleuths as Fiona Harvey. They essentially just cross-referenced her own social media posts from about a decade ago and made the kind of link there.
I think the main tweet they found was, let me hang your curtains. Or
yeah.
Or come over and hang my curtains.
My curtains need hanging badly, yeah. Or something, which of course is one of the specific lines in the show. So Fiona Harvey has gone on to Piers Morgan's YouTube show to
Uncensored.
Essentially give her side of the story, I suppose, or a riposte to some of the allegations that are in Richard Gadd's Netflix drama.
So what were your thoughts before watching it? Like, how did you feel before you watched it?
So yeah, I actually did feel pretty conflicted in terms of the kind of ethics around Piers even having her on in the first place. You know, while she obviously has every right to have a kind of public reply, at the same time, I feel like the whole thing is a massive compliance mess, isn't it? And I think particularly from a journalistic perspective, Netflix and Richard Gadd, in hindsight, actually didn't do due diligence, really.
There's no duty of care. And I think the conversation has been like, this could never have been made in this way, like if it had been at the BBC.
Yes, Russell T Davies, creator of It's a Sin, has said that. You know, it's the compliance department at the BBC drive them nuts, but it helps them sleep at night. I think that Piers, as we well all know, is a bit of a scumbag, and he's never going to care about the kind of ethics and the morals around a story like this. He clearly just wanted clicks, and my goodness, like, did he get them? It's had millions and millions of views. I think he tried to frame his kind of way in as being sympathetic towards Fiona Harvey. But I think it's pretty obvious what Piers is doing. He just wanted that story. And I felt a little bit guilty, I guess, to watch it because I felt it's kind of fanning the flames.
Yeah. And it was strange because as I was watching it, there were these two sides to Piers. I agree with you. I thought ethically it was really grim. I think if she's got a mental illness, like, it's not responsible to have her give her views to like millions of people. But I also thought there was a strange sympathy from Piers that was developing throughout the interview, in that he was clearly realizing that she was mentally unwell, or maybe he hadn't quite realized it before. And he was therefore like speaking to her like a child and being like, you do realize that if you did send those emails, people will be able to find them. And, you know,
there will be evidence. There will be evidence. 41,000 emails were sent.
He kept talking to her, like essentially trying to give her a lifeline, being like, you know, maybe you sent the emails, but you didn't harass him. But then, on the flip side, he would suddenly like flip into police interrogation mode. Like, how many emails? How many email accounts did you have? 4 or 6? Is that 4 or 6? What degree did you get? The way he asked her those questions.
I mean, she didn't help her case, saying that she has 6 email addresses.
Yeah.
And various phone numbers. I did feel that she wasn't particularly convincing, denying much
she
of the allegations.
Totally shot herself in the foot.
I do get that she wanted to focus very much on the discrepancy of the show versus real life in terms of the criminal conviction that the stalker, Martha / Fiona, got. Obviously, in real life, she was never convicted.
And so Gadd never pressed charges.
Yeah, so I get that there are several discrepancies from the show to real life that she can very much like hang her hat on, if for want of a better phrase, with this whole thing. Like, I can see why she'd be kind of outraged. Oh, there's lies in this program and it's not the truth. However, she is not doing herself any favors in terms of making it seem like she did indeed to stalk him. She did send the 41,000 emails. Even her Facebook posts since doing the Piers interview very much chime.
The intention of the interview felt wrong from the get-go because it's so clear that it was her. So being like, is it her? Is it not her? Yeah. Just like, of course, we know it's her already. So it's, you're just setting her up to fail. You're setting her up to ridicule herself.
It felt To me, it felt exploitative to an extent because it's not Fiona Harvey.
It's not like it's this big ethical case where like, but could she really be the stalker? And it could be this huge miscarriage of like the internet of justice, the internet sleuths framing this woman. I think we all know that Fiona Harvey's
stalker. I mean, even Piers says that afterwards. He's like, having spent an hour with her, I have no doubt in my mind that she bears a striking resemblance to Martha Scott in the show, both in terms of her like physical appearance and also her like mannerisms or the way that she speaks, I suppose, which I found odd because Jessica Gunn, the actor who plays Martha in Baby Reindeer, has specifically said that she didn't look into the real person. The sort of tonality though is quite similar.
Yeah, speaking quite fast, but she doesn't have the phrase. Laugh, I guess. The laugh was very much fictional.
Well, she just didn't really laugh. I think the really big problem and why Netflix have got themselves into hot water here is, as Piers does say at the start of the interview, the fact that at the beginning of the show, in the credits, it says this is a true story. Usually a kind of get out of jail card for these kind of shows are based on true events, inspired by a real story. But it didn't have any of that caveat. It said this is a true story.
Yes, I think as soon as you... I mean... Every time I see that as a journalist, I immediately Google the true story behind the show. But I do that anyway, even just as like a viewer, I would do that. I do that even when it doesn't say this is a true story. But yeah, you're right. I think that is where it went wrong. But then if it hadn't had that, Richard Gadd would still have probably dropped enough hints in interviews. I don't know. I think it still probably would have become clear somehow. Also, I can see how it was really important for him to say, this was my experience.
Yeah, and he has to be able to kind of tell his truth. But equally, I think it's a bit disingenuous for Richard Gadd to suggest that every possible kind of precaution was taken to cover the identities of the people. Like, they just weren't.
Totally. I think he has every right to tell his story, and it's a harrowing one. And I'm like so impressed that he's managed to turn it into art and like managed to heal himself through it. But agreed, I don't think he went anywhere near far enough to try and disguise the identities of the real people, and then made a big kind of sanctimonious show of being like, this is not about outing people and please stop looking for people. It's like, you tweeting that means nothing. You know what the internet is like. Like, it's just for show, you're tweeting that.
Totally. And he did an interview with The Hollywood Reporter recently where he said, if I wanted real people to be found, I would have made a documentary.
Are you done?
Come on. Of course people were going to look when you literally preface the entire show with, this is a true story.
So a bit of gossip from the front line I've heard from people over the last week when talking about this with industry friends, that Richard Gadd is not the nicest person and they can totally imagine him not caring.
Oh.
Yeah. And that like some of the rumours about him being difficult to work with are true.
I mean, I think what's happened with Sean Foley is really awful as well. So if you don't know, guys, there is a comedy writer who has been wrongly accused of being the rapist in Baby Reindeer, Darian, that's what he's called in the show. And Richard Gadd himself had to do a statement saying that people are being wrongly accused in court, including Sean Foley, people that he loves. And as Richard Osman pointed out in his Rest is Entertainment podcast, why on earth did you cast an actor who looks like Sean Foley if on a tiny bit of kind of digging, internet sleuths would be able to find that you did work with Sean Foley on a TV show within a timeline that then could possibly kind of be used as evidence? I mean, I'm explaining that badly, but I think that's super irresponsible for them to have cast an actor that looks like someone that he's known and worked with that could have the finger pointed at them.
I mean, part of me is like, it could just be a coincidence. Richard Gadd might not have been involved in the casting. I actually don't know. But then, yeah, I agree. And also, I was thinking, like, would the show have lost any of its potency had he really gone ham on changing every conceivable detail, like not using any of the same emails? Because obviously we know that he used like word for word all the emails.
Yeah.
And so much of it is like word for word what Fiona Harvey sent. But like, he could have changed them all.
I think he could have changed details like her previous life as a lawyer as well. I mean, that's a key identifying fact.
Key.
And yet he said, oh, I changed the identity so much so that the people wouldn't even recognise themselves.
I think for him, it was so deep for him. It was such a memoir for him on screen that he couldn't, I felt like he couldn't write it in any other way. I felt that's not that I'm agreeing with him, but I can imagine him being like, I need this to be as close as to what happened as possible for me to really...
Yeah, and I totally get that he should be able to tell his emotional truth.
Yeah.
But I just think to cover their backs, both he and Netflix, and really it's actually Netflix's responsibility, like they're the ones that made this show, they just should have put inspired by real events instead of this is a true story. Okay, gang, I've just got back from Mexico and I need to tell you about how amazing it was to be able to bring my London Nootropics adaptogenic coffee sachets there with me. You all know by now how much we love London Nootropics, but honestly, you honeys that haven't yet tried it have got to stock up before the summer holidays because I promise you will be converted.
And we have a discount code, so keep listening.
We do. So I packed about 30 sachets for Marlon and I for our 2-week holiday, and it was honestly absolute heaven having one every morning, sat on the balcony reading while the Airbnb instant sat sadly in the corner. It also made me feel so good in myself every day.
Stunning. I am definitely going to do the same when I also go to Mexico later in the year. Which blends did you bring, babe?
I actually brought a mix so we could choose each day depending on our mood. Guys, if you don't know, then adaptogens are basically natural plant extracts that massively enhance our well-being, and each London Nootropics blend utilizes different ingredients of the absolute highest quality for different purposes. My OG favours flow. You all know I love lion's mane, but I wanted to have enough for those days while also bring mojo because it's so helpful. The cordyceps in it is shown to rapidly reset our body clock, and so it really, really helps with jet lag.
You know that's my absolute fave. I literally cannot go to the gym without it anymore.
I also brought the calm blend with L-theanine for the mornings when I'd had a few too many margs the night before and was feeling a little bit anxious, so that was very handy, can't lie.
Classic. Guys, upgrade your coffee game like us at londonnootropics.co.uk using the code STRAIGHTUP, all one word, no caps, for 20% off at checkout.
Thank you so much to our amazing partner, London Nootropics. Yeah, and I think it's even just about the infrastructure of kind of care around it. So Marina Hyde did her column on this last week, and she says that when Michaela Cole was making I May Destroy You, which is her story of her own sexual assault, and there were independent lawyers, there was an extensive pastoral support system, the defining characteristics of the real people were unidentifiably different. Other people have managed to make shows like this and still protected the identities of other people involved, so you can't say that it wasn't possible.
Totally. I think Richard Gadd really wanted to people to know what he had been through.
But we all know what Michaela Cole's been through.
I know.
And yet the individual responsible hasn't been identified. But then I guess on the flip side, some people are saying maybe this is what Richard Gadd wanted, and he wanted the real life Martha, whether that's Fiona Harvey or not, to have some kind of revenge he wanted to exact.
It's funny because I'm really seeing two sides developing. Like, some people have really crossed over to the team Fiona Harvey side. And actually, I have become more and more empathetic to her.
But then she is not helping herself. Like, I saw she's doing a club appearance.
Oh, my God. No. I mean...
And things like that. So it's tricky.
God.
And I wonder if she actually will sue Netflix. If she does sue Netflix, she does have a leg to stand on. That's the thing.
I felt like every single thing she said was a lie.
Like, yes.
Even being like, yeah, you know, we're consulting, we're suing everyone, we're like working on it.
And just the way, yeah, it literally did feel like Martha in the show, didn't it? Me and my important friends.
Me and my boyfriend, Laura, yes. 5 years.
Does she actually have a boyfriend, Laura? Or when she says, just even the way that she'd kind of like constantly contradict herself. So when she says that she was top of the class at school, and then Piers is like, what grades did you get?
Oh, God.
And she's like, oh, you know, average grades, not top of the class. It's like, you literally just said you were top of the class.
That bit was excruciating. I kind of see journalistically, like, if the whole interview is set up so you can establish whether Fiona is lying or not, you kind of do have to drill into those moments so it's clear that she's lying. But he did go ham on the interrogation. To be fair to him, I mean, she's clearly a clever woman because the way she can think, she can lie
so quickly.
Quick
thinker,
You know, even the stuff like, which made me kind of doubt whether she was even lying, actually, when, you know, when Piers is like, oh, is your boyfriend who's a lawyer involved in, you know, is he part of your legal team? And she's like, oh, no, I'm keeping him separate. Yeah. Like, stuff like that feels very believable. Like,
It was disconcerting as well, because I felt like Fiona Harvey did remind me of Martha in that she feels far more compos mentis in real life than in the written word. Like, Fiona Harvey in the show comes across as fairly sane.
Yeah.
But when you look at her Facebook statuses since, it's literally exactly like all of the messages in the show, but this time it's kind of looking at Piers and so on.
I also wondered, you know, how she kept saying she hadn't watched the show but then was able to like meticulously reference so many different details. I'd be like, oh, my friend's daughter told me about the rape scene this morning. And I was like, okay, what, on the school run?
I have heard about the sexual assault at the canal.
Like,
you've just heard about it or you've seen it. I mean, again though, if something like that didn't happen, then it was pretty risky for Richard Gadd to include embellished details within a story that does have some truth and is being sold as a true story.
Yeah, I think she's watched the whole thing. That was my impression. What did you think that?
Slightly.
Yeah. Oh, God. I mean...
But that would be horrific, wouldn't it, to watch a show like that? I mean, gosh, I don't know. It's so, so difficult, like, where the duty of care lies.
Also, I have to say, I mean, Piers is a scumbag, as you say, but the fucking commenters, I was watching it live. So I was watching live stream of YouTube comments, and they were just gross, like ridiculing her, you know, making comments about, like, as you know, how she says, like, oh, Piers, bit unflattering for you to compare me to,
oh God,
to Jessica Gunning. And then people are like, lol, you'd be so lucky.
I find that whole conversation really awkward. And again, it taps into how she's quite vulnerable. The Piers did want to push on that. This idea that she is physically similar to Jessica Gunning, the actress, whereas obviously Fiona Harvey takes great offence at that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really uncomfortable.
And I think one part of the conversation that people have been worried to have, and maybe the mainstream press, but I have read a few Medium articles and Substack articles on this, is this idea that a larger woman, someone who is maybe not conventionally attractive, is therefore more repellent in terms of the idea of a villain. Like,
yes,
could we not have someone who is a stalker who isn't maybe playing into those tropes of what we find unattractive in conventional society? Maybe it wasn't purposeful, but it felt to me intentional that they tried to make her non-conventionally attractive.
Prior to Fiona Harvey being outed, I actually assumed that Jessica Gunning looked wildly different to the real person. I thought they had gone out of their way to cast an actress that physically bore no resemblance to Fiona Harvey.
Yes. I guess that was the
subtext of what Richard Gadd was saying, I thought, in interviews when, for example, as I mentioned earlier, he said there's no way that the real life Martha would even recognise herself.
Yes, that's so true. Yeah, no, I guess I thought that as well. And I think it plays into this idea of what we see as villainous. Like, there's that whole conversation about, like, baddies on film always having a facial disfigurement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or, like, again, these women who are unhinged or unattractive.
Well, on that,
yeah,
I'm loath to bring up your fave, NSL, but even just seeing Dua Lipa's skit with the, like, hideously unattractive creature, I found that really off-key. Having only seen 30 seconds of it, to be fair, I was like, that seems really weird. I don't like that.
Yes. SNL are just obsessed with making skits about, like, whether someone is hot or not. Like, with Sydney Sweeney, it was all about her, like, oh, as a Hooters waitress, she makes, like, £36,000 and tips because she's got her tits out. Or, like, Jacob Elordi is all about, like, being so hot on an episode of The Bachelor. Oh, I don't know.
Feels a bit lazy.
Feels a bit, like, yeah, noughties.
Yes.
I also have a bit of a mea culpa for Dua Lipa.
Oh, yeah. Go on. Tell the Huns.
Genuinely all weekend banging out Radical Optimism. Absolutely love the song Maria.
You were wrong. Well, we can say it.
Look, I think what it is if you listen to Dua Lipa in the sun, sometimes on a run, it does conjure up the feel-good vibes that become slightly addictive. And that's exactly how I listened to Future Nostalgia. It was going on runs in May in the sun, and I did that this weekend with the heat wave.
See, I enjoyed it in the sun, but with a moth cocktail in hand. I was drinking the new Cosmos. We're actually just having a Paloma right now. So Moth Guys, you know, the canned cocktails, who I didn't realise, but they have the market share in the entire UK on margaritas. So we wanted to try their newbie, the Palomas, which are a tequila cocktail, and they are so tasty.
They
great
are so
for these
refreshing.
Hot days.
I had several over the weekend. I'm really enjoying one now with a slice of grapefruit over ice. Gorge.
The perfect partner to Radical Optimism.
Say it again.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. However, can I just caveat? I still don't think it's anywhere near as good as Future Nostalgia. And I must say that the lyrics, me and a friend were laughing about this over the weekend, how one of them is like, and he said, hey, and I said, hey, hey. That is the chorus of one of the main songs.
And he said, hey, and I said, hey.
Yes.
Which one was that? It's not ringing any bells to me.
It's End of an Era. And it's like the main chorus. I mean, very catchy chorus. But yeah, we were just like lolling. And the lyrics on The Walls Have Eyes is particularly naff. I think it's great as background music, as you said. But as soon as you start listening intentionally, you're suddenly like, come on, Dua, you're a clever girl.
It's
do better.
Modern day
do
poetry.
Better. So I stand by everything we said, but I just have an update.
Slightly.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Fiona Harvey, and then we can wrap up on that. One thing I found quite insightful was that she got paid £250 for that interview.
I saw
that. What a weird fee. That feels like not a proper fee, almost like they were just covering her expenses.
That's a Vogue 1,200-word essay fee. Yeah. Still not enough. I think she should have been paid £10,000 for that interview.
I think now people are saying she may get a book deal. So she can make some money out of that?
I don't know. I mean, oh God, I was actually thinking, like, how long until someone creates Fiona Harvey merch?
Oh my goodness.
Hang my curtains match. It's going to happen. I bet it already exists.
I will be intrigued to see where she takes this. In terms of money as well, one of the things that Marina Hyde points out when comparing kind of Netflix and the BBC, because really her article is arguing that if the BBC had fucked up on this level, it would be a completely different fallout. There'd be calls for resignations, all that kind of jazz. And she says that given that the co-chief executive of Netflix got paid $49.8 million last year, where the BBC paid the director general, Tim Davie, $527,000, you would think that, like the BBC, they'd be able to afford a decent compliance department.
Yeah.
Whereas they just don't haven't care. Bothered.
I think they just don't care. They can get away with it. And I mean, look, Netflix aren't going to be feeling guilty about this because this whole ethical, grimly ethical fallout has been great for them. Exactly. They're like probably overjoyed.
Yeah. The execs have just delivered like a record-breaking international hit.
I think, I hope that Fiona Harvey can get something financial out of this. Like that could probably be the only good thing that comes out from it for her. So I guess I hope that a book deal can work out for her. But I also worry that this just prolongs this interest and scrutiny and like trauma porn for
everyone. Yeah, and if stalking is a mental illness, is it right to kind of prolong her trauma in terms of getting her to write a book about it?
And I think just having a mentally ill person, if she is mentally ill, I mean, we can't say that for sure, but it seems that she is.
She doesn't like that suggestion either. No. In her Facebook post, she's kind of said, and I am massively paraphrasing here, but she's like, all of the public who are trying to pit me as the mentally ill one, like, you're mentally ill.
Yes, and she says that Richard Gadd is the one that has a mental illness.
And he was stalking her. He was obsessed with her.
Although interesting, I did think it was interesting that she chose to say that, no, he didn't come and peep in her house, because I would have thought that would be an easy score for her to be like, yeah, that happened.
Yeah, and another weird discrepancy that Piers weirdly didn't grill her on was her saying that she didn't know where he lives, but then also saying that she had sent him a letter. And it's like, well, then you do have his address. I don't know.
Oh, it was all very odd. But I do think if she is mentally ill, then any prolonged exposure in the public eye is not going to end well. So
no,
I just hope everyone gets bored and moves on to something else.
Bloody typical that Piers would be the one to do this as well.
I know, but then I'm like, but where the problem? The internet caused this, and now we're all watching it.
And we're doing it right now.
Talking about it on a podcast.
And I feel conflicted. It's really difficult because in one way I was like, I don't want to add fuel to the fire. I don't know if I should even watch this. But equally, I felt like we can't not talk about it on the podcast.
Exactly.
It's like such a huge cultural moment.
I remember feeling this exact same of conflicted when Kanye did a big interview, I think with Forbes, when he was like trying to run for president or whatever. I was like, people should not be interviewing him, platforming him. He's clearly
giving
having
it more airtime.
Psychotic break. Like, let's all just stop interviewing him. Yeah. I do think that's where journalists have a duty of care. But then also I'm like, if I was offered a Kanye interview, can I honestly say that I would say no? Because I don't want to harm his mental health. I don't know if I could genuinely back that.
It's really difficult. This is actually making me think, I don't know if you've seen it, of this very strange story from the past week of Bear Grylls baptising Russell Brand in the Thames.
Tell me more about this. I haven't seen much.
So, all right, I'll be honest. I don't know much about it, but the story did catch my attention just because I found it really strange that Bear Grylls would want to kind of align himself with Russell Brand continuously at this point.
And
he's got a very successful kind of mainstream media career. As we touched on last week, talking about Dua and her interview with Russell Brand, so many kind of media figures have been very quick to distance themselves from him. I thought it was an odd choice. I know, of course, he is a very devout Christian, and perhaps it's about forgiveness and redemption, and that's what Bear will lean into. So the two men, I think their friendship goes back to when Russell was on Bear's show Running Wild last summer, and it was right before the kind of series of allegations against Brand were made. So the article I read in The Independent is pegging it as a kind of conversion, which I suppose it probably is, if Russell was getting baptized. I don't know if Russell's doing it probably to try and, you know, improve his public image. But Bear told The Telegraph that faith and spiritual moments in our lives are really personal, but it is a privilege to stand beside anyone when they express a humble need for forgiveness and strength from above. Friendships, when we go through tough times, are worth so much. So I guess he is, you know, kind of confirming that they are indeed friends. I just think it's quite a bold choice of Bear's to be shown like fraternizing with someone that's so obviously been ostracized from the mainstream. I mean, how are Bear's, like many employers, are going to feel about this remains to be seen, but I can't see it going down super well. For example, even with Holly Willoughby, obviously herself no stranger to disgrace men, they're going to be hosting a new Netflix reality show together, Bear Hunt. He's got his celebrity interview series now titled Running Wild with Bear Grylls, The Challenge, which is expected to return for another season on Disney. And yet, as we've touched on, the BBC, who are a long-term employer of Russell Brand, they've already begun removing all of his work from their archive. The episode of Running Wild currently isn't available in the UK. So it just seems like a very, like, brave and risky move from Bear.
Also, like, if you're friends and you felt like you wanted to do a ritualistic baptism thing with him on a friend level, there's so many ways you could have done that privately.
Exactly.
Without the press knowing.
Yeah, it does feel like a media moment that has been contrived purposefully.
I wonder if it's something that Russell has really forced Bear into, like pulling the friends' strings.
Yeah.
I wonder if Bear didn't really want to do it, but Russell was like, please, and I want it. And Russell made sure it was a media moment, because obviously that's great for his image.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly enough, this Independent piece as well does look at Bear Grylls himself as a kind of cult figure. They kind of talk about how his portfolio has been getting increasingly woo-woo and lucrative. So he runs a series of global campaigns called the Bear Grylls Survival Academy, which includes franchises in China and the UAE, which offer 24-hour primal survival experiences. He co-founded an app, Metal, with Paul McKenna and Love Island's Dr. Alex, which I actually didn't know, aimed at improving men's mental health. So obviously that's great. But in 2018, he purchased the British Military Fitness, which was an outdoor fitness company, which he's rebranded to be Military Fit with Bear Grylls. Obviously his Never Give Up live tours, going to Australia next year. So, and I quote the journalist, if he were looking to start a cult, and I'm not saying he is, he'd have a superb base to work from.
Totally. I could so imagine him as a cult leader.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, on that bombshell, Cathers, we have got to nip off.
As it's a speedy one this week. Hope you guys don't mind. We didn't want to leave you without an episode, but as I mentioned during my mental breakdown at the beginning of the episode, we got a lot on our plates.
Got a lot on our plates. To be candid, we didn't know if we would be able to record. We didn't feel up to scratch, but here we
are. Also, not much going on TV at the moment.
No.
I have to say, Dark Matter, the Apple series that I mentioned earlier, is the only decent thing I've watched in the last week that's worth writing home about. And even then, there's only two episodes out, and I wouldn't say it's the best thing I've ever seen, but I am enjoying it.
Do you watch Blue Lights?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
So that new season is out, yeah.
Tell the listeners what it's about, just for a refresher.
Blue Lights is the police drama about what it's like to be police in Northern Ireland and the struggles, the kind of fallout from the troubles and how that affects policing on a day-to-day level.
All right, honeys, well, please do rate, review and subscribe. We will love you forever. If you could pop a little Apple review up, we would be so grateful. Yes. We could even reveal some more embarrassing stories at some point.
Oh yeah, let's do a bait. Okay, yes. Look, if you leave a good Apple review, we will tell you something very naughty.
You had it. That's the promise. All right, guys. Have great weeks. Love you loads. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.